that peaches. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show. I'm Maggie Dawn. She is Anastasia Esther. And you are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Wherever you're going this holiday weekend, do not worry. You can take the entire network with you. Just go get that Civic Media app. That way, when Weird Uncle Joe starts spouting off about some nonsense.
And he will.
Yes, it's just as guaranteed as turkey and pumpkin pie. When Uncle Joe starts with his nonsense, when Aunt Donna says some things that you just cannot abide, just pop in those earbuds, go find Civic Media, and take a little Zen moment to yourself. But better than that, tell all your friends and family, and maybe even Uncle Joe and Aunt Donna and anybody else who needs to hear this stuff, that they too can become enlightened through the Civic Media Radio Network. Locally grown radio with a hometown flavor. Always topical, and hopefully always entertaining. And we spent some time recently on this show talking about some of the norms of international law. We're going to have Professor Mary Ellen O'Connell from Notre Dame Law School, an expert in the law of conflict, the law of war, back probably after the new year. She's right in the middle of exams. It's a little bit hard to get a law prof on a radio show in the middle of exam season, but stay tuned to the Maggie Dawn Show. You never know what kind of great guests we're going to have. She's going to be coming back after the new year to talk with us more. Sadly, when I was emailing with her, she said, listen, I'm just slammed right now. And I said, what about after the new year, Anya? Because I said, odds are we're probably still going to be having this conversation about what to do in that region. Hopefully by then we will have seen the release of the hostages. So important. So that's coming. We've got Aicha Sawa, these wonderful four-letter female A names. We've got Aicha Sawa, the current City of Milwaukee Comptroller, tomorrow on the Maggie Dawn Show. We're going to take a little Thanksgiving break, but don't worry, there'll be some best ofs for you. But today, really, really excited to be joined by my friend Dan Terrio, good friend of mine. Extraordinary man, an incredible personal story, and he is Native American. Dan is part of he's a formally enrolled member of the Stockbridge Muncie Band of Mohican Indians of North Central Wisconsin. He couldn't be any more topical than right now. It's Native American History Month. We'll talk about why that's important. We'll talk about, ever think to yourself, how do Native Americans celebrate Thanksgiving? Kind of a complicated question. We're going to ask Dan that. We're going to get into it. So you're not going to want to miss that this hour on the Maggie Dawn Show. But a little piece of TV arcana came across my radar over the weekend. And given all that is going on in this world, and given my repeated entreaties to take our responsibility as citizens and voters quite seriously, and to truly consider what could be catastrophic implications of a vote for someone who is demonstrably irresponsible, motivated by nothing more than self-interest, with a disdain for international law. This anniversary to me of the film, the television movie that has set the record for most viewers ever. Set it in 1983. 40-year-old record still stands. 100 million people in the United States watched this movie in the fall of 1983. I just thought it was incredibly eerily appropriate to observe the anniversary of this film. And the movie is called The Day After. And I bet there's a whole bunch of you that are thinking to yourself, yes, I remember this. You might have thought I was going to talk about V, but no, that was a series that went on for weeks and a whole millions and millions of us watched that too. But no, this was about a 2.5-hour movie that aired on ABC. It was called The Day After 40 years ago. It took over 2.5 years for this movie to get made because directors would turn it down. It was incredibly controversial because it basically shows and depicts what happens if the United States and the Soviet Union at the time, they place it in the context of the NATO alliance squaring off against Warsaw Pact countries and it devolving into nuclear war. And if you don't know, many missile silos from the Cold War are all over the Midwest. And so what the film depicts is that both of these superpowers let go and let fly nuclear weapons. And it depicts what happens to ordinary Americans in the Midwest the day after. And there was so much controversy about this. The U.S. Department of Defense was concerned about it. People thought folks might literally have mental breakdowns. There were educational guidelines accompanying the film to help ground some discussions. There was a bunch of network advisories that went out. There was a toll-free number that was publicized before, during, and after the film for free counseling. This is before mental health was what it is today. Censors were freaked out. The advertisers were freaked out. Network execs were extremely worried. And to me, it seemed incredibly appropriate to mark this anniversary, given all that's happened. And very interestingly, this was an impeccably researched script, by a guy by the name of Edward Hume. And the writers and the director were very committed to trying to show in a realistic way, not a gratuitous way, but a realistic way, what would happen. And so the big event, the assault, happens about a third of the way through the movie. And here's what's incredible. So that detonation sequence, again, it starts about a third of the way through the movie. You got 100 million people watching. It's the highest viewership of any TV movie ever. That record still stands. Once that detonation sequence started, you may be surprised to hear that ABC didn't air another commercial for the rest of the show. So 2/3 of that movie, after the detonation sequence, after the bomb dropped, no commercials. That is pretty incredible. And those special effects that were depicted in that movie, which, by the way, those special effects back in 83 were pretty state-of-the-art for that time, they won an Emmy. And these special effects did not spare many punches, didn't pull punches. It showed people basically being disintegrated and vast swaths of middle America being reduced to rubble. So again, it's interesting to me to observe how much art informs a particular moment. Certainly at that point in time in the early 80s, right? Many people were concerned about that. Most people alive had been through the Cuban Missile Crisis. We did drills in schools, right? Like put your head down under, get under your desk. Like that's going to happen if the big one hits. I mean, mushroom cloud, my desk is going to help. Anyways, and here's what the Washington Post said about the film The Day After back in 1983. Who should watch this movie? Everyone. Who will be able to forget it? No one. And so maybe it's something that we all need to remind ourselves, especially right now with everything that is happening in this world, which I will just generally mark as destabilization, the rise of authoritarian regimes, the ascendance of basically racist, Nazi-adjacent, exclusionary movements across Western Europe, as well as the United States, Central and South America. It might bear watching because it stands as a stark reminder that in those moments, there are only a few people who will decide what happens. And we've heard from nearly everyone that has worked in the Trump administration at the highest levels, including his attorney general, his joint chiefs, military leaders, basically say that this man cannot be trusted to make these decisions. And the coda of this movie, I wanted to share with everyone. So if you're not a musician or you don't know what a coda is, it's like the very last phrase that a piece of music or art gives you as its parting, hopefully most memorable point. And here is what the director had to say at the end of The Day After, 1983's ABC's The Day After. It is hoped that the images of this film will inspire the nations of this earth, their people and their leaders, to find the means to avert this fateful day. It was true in 83, and it's true today. So with that reflection, we're going to turn the page. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about some weird stuff that happened at a Formula One race in Las Vegas. I mean, what? First of all, I didn't know Formula One happened in Vegas. It did, and something went terribly wrong. So you're going to want to stay here for that. And after that, coming up on the Maggie Dawn Show, going to be joined by my good friend Dan Terrio. He's going to help us all understand what Thanksgiving means to all of us, including Native American folks. Keep it locked here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Get a fast car. I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something. Me, myself, I got nothing to prove. A fast car. I got a plan to get us out of here. Been working at the convenience.
You're getting in a fast car and getting out of here for your Thanksgiving break. Don't take Tracy Chapman's word for it. You can listen to the Civic Media Radio Network and, you know, find some fun information, some good entertaining political discursives anywhere that you will be driving. Just this past weekend, took a bit of a road trip. Boy, is that fun. I don't lose signal. Just all the good vibes from the Civic Media hosts across the network. So check it out, everybody. You can get the Civic Media app for free anywhere that you like to get your apps. But you can join us this afternoon, 844-967-2789. Don't forget, going to be joined by Dan Terrio coming up at the bottom of the hour. Stay tuned. You're not going to want to miss that. But Formula One, which I think is so fascinating. I'm not a big car NASCAR. Okay, that's not my thing, but I stumbled across the, I don't know if it's a Netflix series. I forget what it's called, but it's basically all about Formula One, which is basically a study in like rich people sports. It's, you need, it's, purses are a half, $500 million is the purse for the Formula One race in Vegas. That's a half a billion dollars. Anyways, most classically, what I thought of Formula One was Monaco and driving through these city streets at breakneck speeds. The track in Vegas is 3.85 miles. It does use the strip, and there's 17 turns in 3.85 miles. And then if you're not familiar with F1, you go as fast as you can while driving those 17 turns. It's extremely dangerous and extremely expensive and usually goes down. These races are held in fancy pants places all across the world. Well, before the actual race, they have practice because every F1 track is a little different. And so the Formula One race was run in Vegas this past Saturday, but their first practice on the track was Thursday. Now, Vegas, a little bit busy at all hours of the day and night, wouldn't you say? I like to call it the DMV with strippers, booze, and drugs. It's a lot of people. Not a huge fan of Vegas. It's a topic for a whole nother day. But their practice runs, they only allowed to happen between midnight and 4 a.m. so that the entirety of Vegas wouldn't be screwed up by the F1 race. So the practice run starts, it goes for 8 minutes, and then the 35,000 fans that are there to watch the F1 practice run are kicked out because what, Anya? You were the one that let me know about this story, so I can't take credit.
Yeah, that's right. So I guess this was the first year that F1 decided, hey, we're going to have a Grand Prix and we're going to have it in Vegas and we're not going to build a track for it. We're going to use the city streets. And I'm not into F1. I'm not into racing. I'm not really into sports, but I love drama. And this YouTuber I follow named Swell Entertainment flew out in advance of the Prix. And she got a taxi to go around the track. And she was commenting on like, oh, that's not quite right. That's not, that's interesting. And one of the things she and many, many, many other experts, if you can call them that, experts on F1 on city streets, said was, hey, whenever other cities utilize city streets, they have to weld the manhole covers down because these cars are so low and so fast. And even though manhole covers are really heavy, something, something physics, they suck the manhole cover up and then you just have like a 40-pound discus under a car going like 110 miles an hour. And a lot of people are asking, Vegas, you're running out of time. Vegas, it starts tomorrow. Vegas, will you weld the manhole covers down? And we got our explosive answer during that pre-race, that practice. A car was able to pull a manhole cover up. And the result was like a huge Roman candle out of the back of this car. They had to shut down that track for the rest of the day. That car is kaput. It's a real mess. And all of it could have been avoided if we'd listened to the experts ahead of time, which sounds like a resounding thesis for many topics lately.
Doesn't it, though? You know, math, maths, physics, physics. I'm not a physics person, and as soon as you told me manhole cover and Formula One, I went, yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah.
It's like a jet airplane. You know what I'm saying? Like, you drive, listen, people, let's think of it in very simple terms. You take your Kia, you go out, you drive over a bunch of leaves. What happens to the leaves? You know, they flutter up behind your vehicle.
Now, Maggie, that feels targeted because while I was in DC, the whole 16 hours I was out of town, my Kia did get jacked.
Oh,
so this feels quite targeted, ma'am.
Hardly. Pick. How about my O2 Honda?
There we go. I'll take that.
My O2 Honda. So you don't have to have a physics degree to know what happens here, right? And it took out one of the top contenders for F1, a guy by the name of Carlos Sainz. He's a Ferrari driver. Ferrari apparently always in the running for F1 championships. And just like NASCAR, if you're more familiar with that format, there's a whole series, right? It's the F1 series over a season. And it's whoever maxes out the points by getting the greatest number of highest placements in the total number of races that they have. And he was effectively out of the running. One of the things that, by the way, this was the first time F1's been in Vegas for 41 years. I guess we know why now. Yoy. And most Las Vegans, is that what it's called? Are they vegan, but not a vegan?
Vegasites, maybe?
A Vegas, that
they
sounds
wouldn't like
bad
that
too.
One, no. A Vegasite is something you pick up.
Right, while in Vegas that you don't talk about.
Don't talk about it.
Don't talk about it. They were really mad because the city expended millions to try to prepare the track, so to speak. Then this happens, and oh, today, those 35,000 fans filed a class action lawsuit against Formula One because what they paid for, they certainly did not get when they got booted off the track at midnight in Vegas after seeing 8 minutes of a practice run where tickets were running $500 and up just for the privilege of seeing the practice run. I don't get it, folks. But just if you're keeping track, the winner of the F1 in Vegas this past Saturday was Verstappen of Red Bull car number one. That's all I got for you. Did Ferrari come in? Yeah, they came in with a different driver, Leclerc. You may have heard of this guy, Leclerc, Ferrari car number 16 coming in second. Whew. Listen, keep it locked, everybody. We're going to have a few important messages. Come back with my friend, Dan Terrio, right after this. Buy a bigger house and live in the suburbs. Back, everybody. I am Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. If you want to join us this half hour, it's going to be something special. 844-967-2789. I have been joined by my very good friend, Dan Terrio, who is an enrolled member of the Stockbridge Muncie Band of Mohican Indians of North Central Wisconsin. But let me tell you a little bit more about Dan, and then I'll let him introduce himself, because I have to brag on my friend. He spent two terms as the national co-president of the United Nation Indian Tribal Youth, Inc., Unity, which is the single largest Native American youth organization in the country. He's been to all 50 states. He's a TED-certified speaker. He's a trainer in the areas of Native American and Two-Spirit issues, diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, and leadership development. St. Norbert for his undergrad, UWGB for his master's. He's got a Cornell University certificate of D&I, diversity and inclusion training. And if he wasn't accomplished enough, he's now going to go get his PhD in applied social justice from Dominican University. Welcome, Dan. So happy to have you here on the Maggie Dawn Show.
Thanks for having me, Maggie. Glad to be here.
Yay. So let's start with the basics. It's Native American History Month.
Yes, it is.
Why is this so important for us to observe?
Native American history is American history. I think, you know, first and foremost, you have to recognize the land that we're on is Native land. You know, this was ours first. And so starting there, but then understanding that we're still here. You know, I think there's this perception, especially because you talk about what has happened to Native Americans within American history. You forget to mention we are still here. We are thriving. We are resilient. We are sovereign nations. And each tribe has something unique about it that really just draws people in. And I think that's something that this month is really to celebrate is the struggle, but also the resiliency that we exhibit today.
I think that's so important. We've talked about this in the context of African American History Month, Latina and Hispanic Awareness and History Month is not just observing and reflecting as is necessary the actual history of what's happened, but the resilience and the vibrance and the contributions of all of these different peoples that make up current America. 9.7 million Americans currently identify as Native American. 13% of those folks live on tribal lands. You're just saying a moment ago that each tribe has some unique aspect and element. Tell us a little bit more about the Stockbridge Munsee Band of Mohican Indians.
Well, we are the last of the Mohicans. I think that's the first thing I'm going to just point out. We are actually one of the two final descendants of the Mohican Nation. We are upstate New York based tribe. And the story behind it is that our people were starting to wipe out. We're literally due to disease, a multitude of things. And the tribe that was left branched out into two. Am I not in front of the mic? Oh,
there you go. That's better.
Okay.
Yes.
Here I am in like social conversation. I'm just like, oh, there's a mic here. So the tribe branched out where a group went one way and then another group went the other. My tribe, we merged with the Munsee Delaware people of Massachusetts and formed this new nation within Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and eventually moved from Massachusetts to the Ohio River Valley to the southern tip of Lake Winnebago here in Wisconsin to our permanent home in north central Wisconsin and western Shawano County. We have about 23,000 acres in federal trust. We have it's a very small tribe, roughly about 1,700 members. We're the eighth largest tribe in the state. There's 11 federally recognized tribes here in the state. But the history there, especially being an East Coast based tribe, is something that really kind of shapes, because I went out to our homeland and to see where we were and where we're at now. Like, why did we move? But we were forced out.
Yes.
Just have a multitude of reasons. So, I mean, we have the music, we have the food, we have all of that that really just kind of makes our tribe whole. But for me personally, the one thing that I learned and that I'm so proud of, and it's really kind of led my work in public service, is the power of community. I could literally go into my neighbor's house, dig through their fridge, and it's never a thing of, Dan, why are you looking through my fridge? It's Dan, do you want to stay for dinner? And that's the type of community I grew up in, that we took care of each other, we took care of our own. And that's something that really has stuck with me in my career as a trainer, as a motivational speaker, and as a scholar, really, in studying and understanding social justice issues in the United States.
It's really fascinating because I just spent some time over the weekend revisiting the Supreme Court ruling that established birthright citizenship. It's this very interesting history behind that case. And what was happening when that decision came down was basically the vilification of Chinese Americans and arguments that they weren't assimilating and joining into culture. Well, American culture, how that was defined in a very Eurocentric time in the late 1800s and early 20th century. What I find really interesting is you see these arguments leveled against different racial and ethnic groups over time as if it's that group's fault, which is fascinating because more often than not, as was the case for Chinese Americans at the time, and indeed Native Americans, the laws and the culture of the United States actually enforced separation and prevented assimilation in a lot of ways. Before we hopped on the air, Dan, we were talking a little bit, and I was hoping you could help all of our listeners out there understand a little bit about terminology. I think a lot of people get freaked out. They don't want to use the wrong language and potentially offend someone inadvertently. Can you help folks, for example, that unity group that you helped lead when you were a young person, it uses the word Indian. In other contexts, we hear Native American, First Peoples, Indigenous, Native Alaskan. Can you help folks understand those terms and when they should use, what are their meanings and how should they be deployed?
I think that's a really good question because this is one question I get a lot amongst others. My tribal, the official government name, and I have my issues with saying government name here. The way that we are classified by the federal government is we are the Stockbridge Muncie Band of Mohican Indians, and we still utilize the term Indian as our formal tribal name. You may hear us also go by the Mohican Nation, the Stockbridge Muncie Band. I mean, the list can really go on. Unity in particular was founded in 1976 in a time where you use the word Indian right. was used a lot. And so the answer to this question is, you know, it's really left up to the interpretation of the individual. You know, it could be Native American, it could be American Indian, it could be Indigenous, it could be First Nations. I mean, like UW Green Bay, my alma mater, they have a whole First Nations program there. And so it's really dependent on the individual. It depends on the tribe. I hear the word Indian used quite frequently. And honestly, like, it's really left up to the tribe and the individual kind of how they want to define and describe themselves. I mean, we're just happy we're here. You know, we're happy that we're still a resilient people, that we're, you know, proud of our culture. And really, you know, all of those terms are all encompassing. It was used as a negative at one time, but I think it's also taking that ownership when you think about even in the American Indian movement, the AIM times. Yes. I mean, that was used a lot. And actually, depending on, you know, the older elders in our community, they would actually say it's American Indian versus Native American. So it really depends on the generation and where they come from.
If someone has someone that they know is Native American, is it okay to ask someone, hey, how do you describe yourself? How do you describe your Native identity so that you, the friend of who doesn't come from that background, uses the right terminology? Are folks open to that?
Absolutely. I think they'd rather you ask than assume. And so if you were to just, you know, say, what is your, you know, perception of this? Because again, it goes tribe to tribe, depending mm-hmm. on how they want to be described. So it's better to ask than assume.
As always and ever, right? And I teased our discussion a little bit before we got to the bottom of the hour, because I thought, what a wonderful, it's obviously the week of Thanksgiving. Everybody's in furious preparation mode. And I thought, hey, what an important question for all of us folks to ask someone who is a Native American of a First Nation, did your family celebrate Thanksgiving? Do you still? How does your tribe memorialize? Is it even a celebration? How is this viewed? Does it vary from tribe to tribe? Help us, all of us folks that don't know, understand.
So there are three questions. I'm 39 years old, and there are three questions I've been asked my entire life. Number one, did you grow up in a teepee?
Oh, Lord.
Mm-hmm. Number two, are you fluent in your language? Mm. And number three, do you celebrate Thanksgiving? And so, you know, this question is not off limits with me. I'm like, I'd rather you ask, and I will give you an honest question, perpetual teacher all the time. But I have a love-hate relationship with Thanksgiving. Mm. Number one, I love to eat. I mean, that's, and any Native person will tell you the same thing. It's like, yeah, like you're giving me free food.
Yeah, I'm there for it.
All good for that. But then there's still that hate piece in terms of understanding what had happened.
Right.
Everybody assumes Thanksgiving, it's the way that we were taught in grade school, that it was this joyous occasion that brought together the Pilgrims and the Indians, and they enjoyed this delicious feast. But nobody talked about the genocide, talked about the maiming of a culture in that moment. And so that's not lost on me on this day. In fact, my friends over in the East Coast, the Wampanoag people, who were the tribe that met the Pilgrims, called this the National Day of Mourning. It's literally the day to remember what happened to their people. Like anything that, you know, horrendous that has happened to Indigenous people, we carry that with us, and it's our guide. It's what guides us in that next phase. And so in my family, we celebrate not on Thanksgiving. We actually celebrate shortly thereafter. So this year it's a Saturday, and it's just our time to get together as a family, eat, socialize, you know, whatnot. But it's not lost on us what the day is about.
One to grow on, everybody. I think so much reflection and so much to be said about a complete a constant lifelong learning process to actually seek out history in all of its very formed ways, right? One of the things that I have been embarrassed of and done things to remediate is that as a native Wisconsinite with these 11 First Nations being from Wisconsin, I was taught scarily little about Native Americans. And I thought that's such an enormous part of Wisconsin culture. I think there's a lot, the names of things come from indigenous languages. So I'm curious, Dan, what's your perspective on how Native history is taught in schools, but also more importantly, how Native American and First Nation peoples, how kids are treated and taught within our school system? So two totally different but yet related questions.
So I went to I went to a school where it was majority Native American. So we had it enriched right into our school culture. But the one thing that I will say that the state legislature did right was mandating Wisconsin Native American history be taught to fourth graders. And to really talk about Native Americans nowadays, the existence of them within our culture, who they are as a people, what they've encountered. And then I know that even growing up, my brother was one example of this. They went to the different tribes that were in our area. So we had obviously the Stockbridge Munsee and the Menominee people, and actually learning about their culture, actually taking kids to the reservations to see contemporary Native Americans. However, there were things about Native American history that I did not learn. Granted, I went to a school where there was, you know, we were majority Native American. However, there was so much more to learn. And I honestly think, though, the way that education is set up today, it's setting young people up to not know that Native Americans still exist.
Yes.
And so we do have a lot more work to do in terms of Native American history and public education.
Dan, can you stick around for another segment?
Oh my God, yeah.
We could do this for a couple of hours. I love it. You're listening to Dan Terrio. I'm Maggie Dawn. Keep it locked, everybody. This is the Maggie Dawn Show. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. She's on Anya Esther. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Don't forget to go get the Civic Media app and tell all your friends and family about it this holiday weekend. Spread the knowledge, spread the love, because we have guests like my good friend Dan Terrio, an enrolled member of the Stockbridge Munsee Band of Mohican Indians of North Central Wisconsin. We were just talking a little bit about how Native American history is taught in schools, but also how Native American kids are taught. First of all, I love that we've got it in fourth grade.
Yep.
Gee, fourth grade, huh? That's it? What is like a week long? This is me being slightly sarcastic. It would certainly seem to me that given all the current political dialogue about immigration, that we might need to learn a little bit about this in more than just fourth grade, but that's a topic for a whole nother time. It also occurred to me that learning about this, that there might be some echo for you with the current debate that goes on about what is referred to by acronym as CRT or critical race theory, which basically is a critical thinking approach that acknowledges the role that race has in people's lives. It's a university level topic. It's an interdisciplinary one. It's not something that a third grader is learning about. I don't know. But the hysteria from the right around CRT, which to me is, just like all history is, it's a different viewpoint. It's a different reflection. It's a different critical analysis of the way history was written and how we might better understand it and contextualize it today. seemed to me that there might be some echo, some resonance with Native American history. Dan, tell me about how does that debate about CRT and that vilification sit with you, and what does it mean to you?
Well, I think first and foremost, I have to credit my science teachers in high school that taught me that a theory can be dispelled. And so if people don't agree with something that they're hearing, prove it wrong.
Right.
You know, and so when I look at CRT in particular, it's, you know, it's really looking at, you know, law-based, you know, at the effects of law, especially in terms of the social construct of race. There's even a whole subsect of critical race theory that focuses on tribal CRT and understanding the effects of colonization on Indian, on Native tribes. There I go, said Indian, but see, it's built in my culture.
This is why we have these discussions about words.
Exactly. So, and how that's really embedded in, you know, one example that I think where CRT could really play a factor in understanding the issues that are facing Indigenous people today is the concept of blood quantum, which a lot of people, you may have heard of this term before. I'll just use it in a real life example. My dad held me for 15 minutes after I was born. He had to hand me back to my mom so he could drive the hour to get to our tribal enrollment office to present a pedigree that showed proof of Native blood. And it was mostly in order for the birth to be paid for. And so we could receive the tribal benefits from there. But he had to present tribal blood proof, so a whole family tree line of Native ancestry. And there are only three living things in our world that require this type of proof of blood: horses, dogs, and Native Americans. And this was perpetuated and created by the federal government as a means to limit land holdings. If you don't have enough blood, you cannot have that land. And then it later carried into tribes utilizing it as a mechanism to have membership, to reap the benefits of different tribal benefits. And so CRT, especially understanding the effects of colonization, that is where that tool could be effectively used to understand how that is perpetuated in the in our current climate. The issue with CRT in particular, though, people confuse it with DEI, so diversity, equity, and inclusion. They confuse it with this. The problem, I'm just going to put this out right there, people don't know what it is.
Of course not.
And so I am a firm believer that you shouldn't legislate on something you don't know. And so if people are going to legislate about CRT or DEI, they first and foremost should learn what it is.
Well, Dan, that would put about 90% of legislation outside the reach of 90% of politicians. Boom, 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 done. Listen, I don't want to run out of time this hour without asking you a bit about you. Self-identify as a two-spirit person. Tell everybody what that is and a little bit more about you, Dan.
Well, the easy way of describing two-spirit is Native American and openly gay. And this is a term that was coined in the late 1980s at an international Indigenous persons conference, where it's been recognized throughout tribal history of a person that exhibits both the masculine and feminine energy. And they many tribes consider it this gift from creator, that they are able to have the nurturing side, but also the warrior side, which in my view could go either way. Every tribe interprets this differently. And in my tribe, initially it was something that we didn't really believe in. I think it was the influence of the church and you know, the teachings that really come from there. So growing up and knowing that I was gay, I couldn't be open about it because every person that I knew of that was gay would leave the community, come out, and you'd never see him again. And so for me, I lived for a long time in that closet, basically having to live a double life here. And then finally, it was like something had changed in our community. The church that I attended as a child, they got their first openly gay pastor. Mm. And so I had a conversation with my dad. I was like, so how's the community handling this? Cause just, I know how they have been. He says, some are okay with it, some are not, but you are who you are. And that's how we need to accept people. And I didn't realize he was giving me permission to come out. So at age 36, I came out in a very public manner, and the outpouring of love from the community was something that I did not expect. I could have had a huge parade going through the tribal community and just celebrating like Dan's gay, you know, like really just celebrating
it. I love it.
But learning from our elders what this meant, I was held up in high regard before, I was held up in high regard even more as a leader. And so with being Two-Spirit, I have to walk a red road of really making sure that I'm embracing and celebrating my culture, being a positive influence to our young people, caring for our people, making sure that our voices are being heard. And it's something that I do every day in the work that I do. And that's what being Two-Spirit is to me and to our people.
Dan, you certainly have been a light in my life. I will forever be grateful for the circumstances that brought us together so that we could forge a friendship that I know will last a lifetime. Dan, why don't you, well, I'm going to do this because we're running out of time. From Dan Terrio and Maggie Dawn, we wish everybody in the civic media universe a very happy celebration, observation, however your family will view this upcoming holiday weekend. Be safe out there, everybody. It's been a Monday edition of the Maggie Dawn Show.